Could you build a business that's better for our planet? That's what I have set out to answer. Hi, I'm Marco Pimentel, marketing expert and entrepreneur and host of the podcast, Someone Like You. I become fascinated in finding creative climate solutions in business, and on the podcast, I break down how founders and CEOs are building climate-friendly business solutions that are opportunities for growth while being better for the planet.
I want people to wear things till they fall apart, and I want them to then feel good about the fact that they've worn it till it's fallen apart, and then, you know, learn how to stitch the hole up and learn how to take care of their clothes and love the fact that, you know, you've put the time into this piece and it's giving you comfort.
Truckloads of our unwanted clothing are shipped to continents like Africa, disrupting their own local economy and causing massive waste. Today's guest is Nagin Azad, designer and owner of Noctex, a slow fashion clothing company that prioritizes form, utility, and ethical design. Nagin grew up loving clothes and started sewing in high school. At age 17, it was the experience of working at a rag yard that Nagin decided that she would work in the fashion industry only if she could do so ethically and with as little waste as possible. I speak with Nagin on how deadstock textiles became the backbone of her company, Noctex, and how she built a brand with a loyal following based on solid ethics, transparency since her humble beginnings selling on Etsy, and how micro trends and fast fashion are contributing to unconscious and wasteful consumerism. With the warehouse now based in Los Angeles, with the hope to have all of her operation based there to remove even more waste, and core values in ethical production that are accelerating the future of fashion, Noctex is proof that slow fashion can be successful, all while keeping our planet in mind. Here is our conversation. I wanted to take a second to tell you about our Season 2 sponsor, Digital Scope. Did you know your website has a carbon footprint? Well, digital technology has a larger carbon footprint than the entire aviation industry, and it's only getting bigger. Digital power consumption is increasing by 9% every year. At this rate, our digital carbon footprint could be responsible for as much as 14% of global emissions by 2040. If you're a digital-first company, or really any company with a website, and want to understand the impact your website is having on the environment, Digital Scope can translate visitor data into carbon measurement, all with a simple one line of code added to your website. Check out digitalscope.com/someone like you. The first 100 people to sign up get free access for an entire year. Nagin, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
I'm really excited to kind of have this discussion because when we think about climate or when we think about sustainability, often we're speaking with founders and people that have been doing this for, you know, quite a few years or had an idea, but you've been doing this for a lot longer and you have, you know, a journey, and I'm really excited to just learn a little bit more around how that journey came to be. So where did your background come in, and was there any correlation to just thinking about, you know, sustainability and fashion or climate and fashion? Like, how did the connection between maybe what you were doing before, or maybe there was no connection, and what you did to build your business?
Yeah, so I grew up always being really interested in clothing and fashion from probably as young as I was, you know, 8 or 7 years old. I was always drawing stuff, and the appeal of clothing and how it makes you feel and the confidence behind it was always really appealing to me. And it wasn't until I reached high school where I started sewing, making more pieces for myself. And I was fortunate enough to graduate high school a semester early because I really wanted to get a head start on my sewing portfolio for university. And at the same time, I needed work. You know, I was looking around on Craigslist, this and that, and I was like, well, I do really want to work in fashion. I want to work in my fields that I'm interested in. And I came across a random Craigslist post that just had two sentences. It was like, we need someone who, you know, can work with vintage clothing. And I think the minimum wage was $8 at that time in 2011. And it was offering $12. And I was like, wow, that is awesome. You know, so I have to apply for this job. They have to give it to me. I don't even know what it is. So I started doing all this random research on vintage clothes so I could like answer questions for them. I said I was 20, even though I was barely 18. And then I was kept calling them because there was a phone number, and I was like, please just give me an interview. And they were like, okay, whatever. So I went to this warehouse, and they were like, yeah, we're a rag yard. We bring in used clothes, you know, and then we pick out the vintage stuff. We need someone to pick out the vintage. And I had no clue what any of that meant, but I showed up, and they actually realized that I was their neighbor. Like the owners lived like two doors down from me, and they recognized me, and they're like, oh yeah, sure. We'll give you a trial or whatever. Do you know how to identify vintage clothes? And I was like, oh yeah, of course. And I was like, no, but I'll search it up, you know, in my head. And it was my first experience, right off the bat, before even going to university or doing anything involved in fashion, to see how much clothing was just thrown away. So there was truckloads of clothes that would come in, you know, just giant truckloads, like freights of clothes coming in. And they were like, yeah, you know, these are basically what's left over from charity shops and, you know, Value Village or wherever else, because, you know, we think that those clothes go to thrift shops and charity shops and they're just sold through. No, they can't even take in most of the stuff that gets donated to them, and they get sold off through to these giant rag yards. And they divide all the clothes individually into these giant piles, like these giant, like little mountainous piles of clothes. And my job was to go through and pick out the vintage items for other shops, and everything else there that was left over that wasn't, you know, garbage, was packed up and sent over to third world countries. And I was like, well, that's nice, I guess. Like, you know, being 18 at the time, I was like, oh, that's nice that, you know, we can send them stuff. And then one of the girls who worked there was like, not really. I mean, it disrupts their economy because they get all of this cheap garbage that we don't want. And they're selling through it. And, you know, we're just basically like trying to get rid of this stuff and give it to them. And I was like, oh my God, that's actually awful. And, you know, I had never even seen this much clothing at once in my life. This was like a, you know, let's say a quarter of a size of a regular Costco. And there's every corner just has like, you know, piles and piles and piles of hundreds of pieces of denim jeans and t-shirts and all that kind of stuff. And I was like, oh my God, like I didn't, like all these things still have tags on them. Like they still have their clearance tags on them. And they're just clothes that never even, you know, made it on someone. And they're already being sent away or burned. You know, the ones that don't get worn or sent off or sold, they're burned. And it like honestly created this immense amount of guilt that I was like, this is the industry that I have always wanted to go to. Like this is it. Like this is what happens. So I was like, you know, like, what can I do? I was like, you know what? I'm going to become a buyer. So I started buying from them. And I started selling on Etsy. I was selling vintage clothes on there. I was selling vintage jackets on there. People were throwing things away because they were missing a button. I was like, I could sew a button on this and sell it to someone. Like, it doesn't have to be thrown away. That kind of was like my introduction to being like, you know, if I'm going to go into this industry, I need to figure out a way to do this responsibly. So I'm not contributing to these, you know, piles of, you know, literal garbage to a certain extent that we pass off to other countries. And, you know, this is a little world that no one even knows about. And I even try to explain to people, it's like, you just don't know how much clothing there is until you physically see it right in front of you.
Until you see mountain piles. So to ask about that, and like you said, most people think about the Value Villages or the thrift stores as this, People buy their clothing, they wear it or they don't. They say, "Ah, time, you know, this is, we don't need this clothing anymore." Next step is to, you know, maybe they sell it used or they then donate it. And then where all that clothes goes to donation, we think that, oh, somebody's going to come in and buy it from those thrift stores. But it's the, all of the thrift stores or all the donation places, they need to then take that clothing that they can't sell, or they maybe just, is it just they have too much of it that then just goes into these rag houses, which then become, you know, places to either distribute, essentially almost, not to say that the clothing is obviously not garbage, but they almost treat it that way and they package and ship it off. Is that kind of a, you know, a fair assumption of what's kind of going on?
Yeah. You know, people like me or other, you know, vintage companies will go through and, you know, we'll find like, you know, dresses and shirts from the 60s and 70s or other things that are, you know, kind of appealing for resale. But even then, there still isn't even enough people to take all that stuff. And, you know, the labor that it takes to go through it too, you know. But yeah, it all ends up there and then it gets compressed and shipped off to countries in Africa if no one takes it, and it ruins their local economy. because there's all this cheap stuff coming from overseas that's being sold off through to them. And then you see pictures and images of clothes that are, you know, washed up, you know, by the water. I'm not sure if you've seen those, like, in these different countries, because truly, if they don't get burned, they get discarded.
Yeah. So you're picking through mountain piles of clothing. You start to, you know, fix, find, and then sell clothing. How did that then kind of turn into kind of fully fledged business? And I guess what, you know, this is, at what year was it that you decided that, okay, time to, you know, really, you know, invest my life into this business?
Yeah. I feel like, so I was, you know, freshly 18. I think it was the day after I turned 18, literally, that I started my Etsy. And I started selling vintage on there. And I was then selling like little accessories that I made. And, you know, this was the summer before I even started my university program, which was a 4-year program. And I didn't expect much. I just wanted to, you know, make some extra money. And I was trying to do it in a way where I was like, okay, you know, get some extra sales here and there. You never know. And at the time, I was, I'm not sure how, like, if you remember Tumblr, I mean, it's still around. Not many people use it as much. But that was like the social media of the time. And I would, you know, post the pictures of the stuff that I made. One of my best friends that lived nearby, you know, she modeled for me. And I, you know, had my dad's DSLR. So I was like, you know, I'll just take pictures, try to make them look nice, like list them up, you know. And I had a few posts that just ended up going viral. And, you know, because people repost them. And it got more attraction. And I was like, okay, cool. Like, this is nice. I'm making accessories. I'm doing this and that. I'm making good money. That's awesome. And one day, I think it was probably within the first year that I was in university, I walked into a print shop and I was like, oh, like, do you guys do other print apparel? Do you guys do like leggings and this and that and whatever? And they're like, yeah, we do. So like, okay, you know, I can make and produce some things on the side, you know, locally. And that's like a big thing for me. I was like, you know, I want to keep things local. I want to keep things circular. I work with people here. And I started doing some print apparel. And again, Tumblr really was like my haven back then. It did well. Like, people were responding well to it. You know, just from selling these few styles and vintage pieces, I was able to, you know, save up, move out. At the time, it was obviously way less expensive to live on your own. And that all transpired up until the second year I was in university. So I was, you know, in school full time while trying to get all this off the ground. And I usually kept it pretty quiet because I was just very much like, I don't know if I was like shy about it, but I was very much like, I didn't want to really discuss it with anyone because it was kind of like my little side project, my thing. And my dad saw that my business was taking off, and he was like, what are we going to do? I'm like, well, I'm going to, I think, produce some styles because I learned how to make patterns, but, you know, I don't know how, like, I don't know where to do that or how to do that. And by luck, honestly, one of the people that I worked with at the print shop was like, hey, I'm leaving this company because it sucks. And I'm going to go work with a company that's going to, you know, produce everything. Like, we can help you produce stuff. And I was like, oh, cool. Like, all here. And they're like, yeah, all here. Start working with them, buying a few rolls of fabric. But, you know, my dad was like, you know, this is ridiculous. Like, you can go get fabric from Los Angeles. Like, let's go to LA. And I was like, well, I don't want to go to LA. I'm like 20 years old. I'm happy doing this. You know, I'm happy with my small little business. And my dad was like, no. Like, he bought me and him a ticket to go to downtown Los Angeles. And he's like, there's a whole garment industry down there. And me being stubborn, I was like, hey, whatever, let's go. We go down there and I see this, I'm not sure if you're familiar, but the last remaining garment district is in downtown Los Angeles. All these factories, fabric everywhere. I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. Went around talking to a bunch of people and then met one guy who had like tons and tons and tons of fabric in this giant warehouse. And he's like, yeah, I mostly carry dead stock. So, you know, we don't really know what we have, but if you want to go through and look, you know, find what you like, you know, we sell it to anyone. We just take over basically rolls of fabric that other people and designers don't want to deal with anymore, similar to the clothes that I dealt with before. Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, why? Like, why would people just like give these rolls away? They're like, well, you know, they're mismatched. They're not like part of the current selection. They're not part of the season. Some of them have sun damage on one side. They don't want to cut around it, this and that. And I was like, well, what happens to the fabric that you don't sell? And he's like, well, we pack it up, sell it to people in Mexico or other places, or we burn it. And I was like, oh, why? You know, like, why would you do that? And I was like, well, if I went through and if I picked a bunch of rolls and I color matched them, could I buy from you in bulk? And I'll design my collections around the fabric that I find. And he was like, yeah, like you can. It's kind of a headache though. I'm like, it's okay. I'll make my own catalogs. You know, I'll measure everything. Like I made my own little like, you know, system on how to keep track of it. And at that time, I think about only like 10, 15 rolls. But, you know, now we buy like, you know, in the hundreds. So that's kind of what started my system of like, wait, like I could do this in a sustainable way. Like people don't want this because it's too difficult for them to organize and deal with. They want to order fresh from a catalog, you know, with clean little swatches brought over from China, this and that. I'm like, no, like I'll go over all these fabrics. I will climb this mountain of like fabric rolls. I'll pull out what I want. I'll double check it. I'll even get people to cut around the, you know, the parts these that are damaged or whatever, because it's still like amazing fabric. It's just a little bit of extra work and I'm willing to do it because honestly, it gives me peace of mind that at least I'm doing something that's creating a little bit less waste and I could stay in the industry that I want with like mostly kind of like a clean conscience. So yeah, that's the gist of how we got to production in a very more sustainable way and how dead stock became the basis of the sustainability of the brand today.
And if you think about dead stock and you think about your experience before climbing that mountain and all that clothes, I guess when we think about fashion, there's just, like you said, there's just a huge, huge amount of waste. And I think what's really interesting about fashion is a personal consumer product. And a lot of times there's this correlation between, you know, what can we do and climate and individuality. This is, you know, what you buy and how you buy it and where you buy it from is very, very intimate and individual. And so I think that's part of these, you know, your story and why you're focusing on that. So how did you go from, okay, I'm going to buy 10 to 15 rolls of dead stock. I'm going to make something out of this and I'm going to name a business. I'm going to start it. And how did you go from that point to getting a name and creating that brand and getting that first, you know, catalog out?
Well, I mean, we started doing everything direct to customer because of Etsy and this and that. And I feel like I gained so much experience from, you know, going online and just listing things and honestly just seeing who would buy them, like just putting myself out there, because the system that I learned in school was quite different. So I always say if I didn't have those experiences very early on, I feel like my education might have not led me to it, because, you know, it's a very specific way of doing things. Because we have like hundreds of styles and, you know, hundreds of pieces. And I have some styles that I've probably put into production so many times that we've easily made, you know, 1,000 plus pieces of them. But I feel like we were able to truly allow social media and the internet and everything to kind of like create this community for us. I mean, we have customers to this day, like many customers that are like, oh yeah, I've been buying from you since, you know, you were selling on Etsy. And I'm like, that's crazy. Cause that was 2011, you know? So I feel like we ended up getting a niche of people and that kind of encouraged me. Cause I was like, okay, this is doing well. Why don't I add one more or two more? But what really pushed me to get to the point where, like, I mean, now we have like three warehouses, we have employees, we have multiple contractors, where we have a warehouse in California we opened a few months ago so that we could, you know, be closer to those manufacturers and to those sources and to, you know, ship from the US. Honestly, it was mostly my dad. He really just saw me doing this, and he's an entrepreneur. He's a guy, he was, you know, a civil engineer. And he really just pushed me to the point where sometimes I was like, you know, I'm happy doing this. I'm happy just sitting in the basement, shipping things out and doing this and that. And he was like, no, like if you have like a potential to do something, you should see it through. And he was very adamant on that. And I feel like he gave me the confidence for it. And I was like, I don't have the money. You know, I literally started my business with $50, about $50 worth of used clothes that I, you know, refreshed, dyed, whatever. And I'm like, I don't have the money for this. And he was like, that's okay. Like, I have a credit card limit. You could put the things you need on the credit card and then just pay them back. I feel like he really believed in it before I did. You know, I was like, I don't know what you're talking about. I'm just selling clothes on the internet. And he was like, no, this is great. So I feel like every step of the way he was like, okay, well, what's next? Like, what can you do next? Like, you know, like, why don't you buy more fabric? Why don't you make more styles? And I was always like, oh my God, like, you're crazy to think that I could do more. But that's what really pushed me to this point. I feel like if he didn't, I probably would have still been just making things here and there in my basement and not buying more fabric or doing more or anything else. So it was definitely the encouragement.
Every week on Someone Like You, we dive into stimulating conversations with founders, entrepreneurs, business owners, and the likes who are consciously and successfully creating sustainable business solutions for the long haul. Tune in every week for a new inspiring conversation on leading climate solutions. And if you're enjoying the podcast, don't forget, please subscribe on the platform of your choice and give us a rating and a review. And when you started, like you said, you were buying this dead stock in LA, you bring it up, you're still selling on Etsy. When did you convert it to and say, this is Noctex, here's a brand, you know, we are, you know, as you said, your dad was helping you, push you along the way, giving you a credit card to do it. So when did you switch to being Noctex and starting with that?
The name Noctex was always on the Etsy from day one. So we stuck to that, but it wasn't until, like, I honestly, I think I just came home one day and I think it was 2013. And my dad was like, okay, well, I bought the domain. All you got to do now is build a website. And I was like, how am I going to build a website? Also, why are we even doing that? Like, we're doing fine. Like, we're doing fine on Etsy. Like, everything's good. And he was like, no, like, learn to build a website, do this, do that. And I was like, okay, whatever. Like, I'll research it. I'll try to figure it out. And that led me to, you know, having the more of an online storefront, you know, moving on to Shopify, doing that whole 9 yards in the back. And honestly, most of the time, everything that I learned, I was like, I don't know how to do this. I will find a YouTube video on it. And like anything you want to learn, there is a YouTube video out there. Yeah, that's how it got to that point. And you know, I was already in university learning so much, and I feel like everything that I was learning in university, I didn't really align. Obviously, the technical skills align with me, but like everything else, they were like, okay, you got to go and make a catalog every few months, make a new season of clothes, go sell it to a bunch of stores and make sure, like, you know, you get 50% of this price and whatever. And I was like, I don't know if I want to do that. And I did try to do that, and it just didn't really work for me. We have a very, very like strong clientele. We have a very high returning customer rate. And it's because from day one, I've been putting my values out there. I've been putting my process out there. I try to be very transparent, both in, you know, the back end of how things are made and why it's made that way, why it's priced that way. And honestly, people are so much more receptive now than they were when I first started. When I first started, the idea of, like, you know, things being made or priced a certain way, people were like, why? Like, why would I do this? Why would I do that? But there was still a clientele for it. We've come so far in the industry in a lot of ways when it comes to educating the customers on clothes. And I think that those early years were very difficult and people were not as responsive. But we've come to a very different time now when it comes to consumerism. And I feel like that's helped even push the brand further because people don't have to ask where things are made or how they're made. It's already on there. It's already on our page. We're already transparent. So we kind of have like a one-up now when a lot of companies are being asked to be transparent and they have to backtrack and try to figure out how they could do that for their customers.
Yeah, we did an episode with Ben Nyland from Loop Energy, and he's been in the energy sector for many, many years. And his comment was that before it was a very push market. You had to push the clean tech and conscious consumerism to people. And now that there's an overwhelmingly change in direction of the markets kind of pulling and asking for the demand is there, and which has been great for the companies that started a lot earlier and the ones that are obviously building now. When you think about just disruption in the fashion industry, where do you want Noctex to play? Obviously, you're focusing on, you know, where fabric comes from, where your products are made. But, you know, if you were to say, you know, where do you want to shine a light on the space, and where do you specifically want to disrupt?
One of the biggest aspects of sustainability, aside from, you know, how things are made, I always say is you know, trend culture. And I always, you know, this is something that I've always tried to explain to people on social media or wherever else, is that our goal whenever we make anything isn't to find a new trend or hop on a new trend and cash in on it. Everything that I've ever made, and we have a lot of things that we still produce from 2012, 2013, like a lot of stuff. The whole point is we're trying to make things that are more so about the experience you have with the clothes, and how every new piece we make, we consider our collections like an ongoing closet or collection. You know, when I make a new thing, I always consider how it would be worn with the thing that my customer more or less already owns. Because we do have a lot of customers that they're like, you know, half my closet is just your clothes, and it's now becoming, you know, most of it. And I like to consider that, because we live in a very high micro trend time right now. You know, trends used to be, you know, let's say like a few years long. If you want to go even back in history, you know, if you want to look at, I don't know, Victorian times, it was like decades long. But now we have micro trends, you know, things that are show up overnight that are super trendy and everyone wants to hop on it. And influencer era of just buying clothes just to look good for a photo, that really like did not do a lot of good things for consumerism. And you have, you know, Shein and all that, that's adding to this insane culture of having the newest trend. But for us, I feel like the disruption that I always have from day one is that my goal isn't to constantly offer 100 new styles or even like 50 new styles each season and then just, you know, throw out the patterns for the rest and say, okay, well, now this is the new thing we're doing. My goal is to focus on slow fashion in the way that it would also be consumed. You know, I want people to wear things till they fall apart, and I want them to then feel good about the fact that they've worn it till it's fallen apart, and then, you know, learn how to stitch the hole up and learn how to take care of their clothes and love the fact that, you know, you've put the time into this piece and it's, you know, giving you comfort. So I'm really trying to work around the relationship people have with their clothes and disconnecting from, you know, why micro trends exist and why fast fashion or hyper fast fashion now, when we speak about Shein, it's truly hyper fast fashion. It can't even compete with mall fast fashion. It's about the relationship you build with the pieces you buy. And I think that's what's really made a difference for us. I constantly get people emailing me or messaging me like, you know, I bought this X many years ago. I still wear it this many times a week. And I'm like, that's what it's all about. Wearing something 100 times instead of, you know, 10 times or 2 times, that's already sustainability in itself, you know, using what you already have.
Yeah, and do you think that is the reason you've been able to scale your business to where it is today? Like those kind of principles is what led kind of customers to try, buy, and then hold on to, and then refer people? Like, why do you think you've been able to get the customers and the support along the way? And I guess, you know, was it a secret marketing mission that you did, or was it really the missions that, you know, and being very public about what you build to be able to get to the growth that you have?
I feel like, you know, like we mentioned, the consumer's culture and demand has changed so much. And I think early on, it just, a lot of people that were, you know, tired of fast fashion, that had any sort of understanding of it, were very responsive, because, you know, companies like us didn't really exist, especially if we're making things that are a bit more like you know, like edgy alternative or whatever. Well, most of those brands are pretty fast fashion. They're not really making new things necessarily to last or anything else. But whenever we design something, we try to show people. And I think this, the best example would be our first real collection that I put into production. It was only 3 pieces, but my goal was to show that these 3 pieces together or apart would be able to be worn in 15 different ways. So the concept was, you know, you have 3 pieces, you take them with you on a trip. These are the many ways that you can wear it. And that in itself is the reason these pieces are, you know, are worth X amount. And from there, my goal often was to make things and show people the versatility of it, you know, how to wear it in the winter, how to wear it in the summer. Like, I don't even really do seasonal collections. I really see things as different layers. And people were really responsive to that. And at the time, that wasn't really common. And most of the stuff we did was, you know, fairly gender fluid and unisex. And that also wasn't very common, you know? And I feel like the more time passed, a lot of people would be like, yeah, you know, people ask me where I got this from. And I'm always like repping your brand. I'm so into it. And I don't even know, like I had no marketing mission. I had no marketing budget. I was still in university by the time I had like multiple collections out. I was still, you know, going to school 5 days a week, and I would just work at night and on weekends on all this stuff. So I really feel like people found us through our, you know, our story, you know, like what we were putting out there. And it was either a really strong reaction one way or another. And that in itself created a very, you know, loyal customer base. And, you know, now we do different ads and we try to like, you know, grow the business and get more people there. But I feel like I never really even put a penny into ad spending until a few years ago. Maybe 3 years ago.
Yeah, it grew. It grew due to its mission, and the brand represented a great ability for people to share
and just real, just real people. You know, real people wearing it, going out, wearing it to work, wearing it every day, and word of mouth was huge with that kind of stuff. So I, you know, we're here because of the core amount of people who saw what I was doing and they believed in it. They, you know, spent that money. And, you know, our prices haven't changed, but I feel like back then spending $60 on a shirt, long sleeve, you know, people were like, this is insane. And I was like, I have to pay people properly. Like, I don't know what to tell you. Like, that's it. Like, I understand if it's out of your budget, I respect that, but I can't underpay people or myself or whatever. And this is what it is. And, I feel like a lot of fast fashion brands, you know, that are trying to look one way or another, their prices can be like fairly comparable at this point, because manufacturing actually even overseas has gone up because freight's gone up. So we were almost like, there's so many companies that their prices are higher than us, and they are fast fashion brands. But I feel good having stuff that I feel like is a good accessible level for a lot of, you know, millennials, and which is our main customer base. And the whole point is to show people that you can buy something that was, you know, made locally, made by, you know, a person that was paid properly, made with deadstock textiles. You can contribute to that without having to have that be a luxury.
And speaking of this growth, if we think about the next 3 or 5 years, where do you want Noctex to go? What's the kind of the continued mission and plan?
Well, we're actually working a lot on moving most of the business to the States at this point, because the majority of our customers are in the U.S. And I've been going back and forth to California, you know, to the Los Angeles area for years because of, you know, vendors and everything else like that. But we opened our warehouse for distribution and fulfillment in August, so August 2022. And my goal for the next, you know, 2-3 years is to have most of the operations down there, because we can then eliminate the need for materials to be brought up, like back and forth. A lot of sustainability, honestly, is a lot of people don't realize, you know, your fabric is grown, your cotton's grown in India, then it's shipped off to China, and then from China, it's shipped again to you. Like, there's a lot of resources in getting a single t-shirt made. So for me, it's very exciting to think that, you know, everything can be now done in Los Angeles. The materials there, the warehouse is there, you know, the people that I work with on a daily basis are there, and it feels like a lot closer. And I would love to have a store where I could, you know, talk to people, like have people walk in and experience the brand and the concept of it all in person. And I do feel like retail is going to make a big comeback, like boutique retail, because of the e-com, almost like a burnout from e-com in the past few years. So I would love to do that and, you know, really bring that experience in a more one-on-one, you know, face-to-face way. Yeah.
Well, as we near our end of our time, I just have a question that I ask at the end. Is I'm a fan of the book The Lorax. I read it to my kids often, and ultimately it's a kind of a cautionary tale about, you know, overusing our resources to the part of being depleted. And at the end, there's a child that catches a seed, and it's kind of like, well, what are you going to do with this seed? You know, do you plant it? Do you get, you know, do you plant more? How do you do it? And I think often a lot of people ask, especially in the business side of things, entrepreneurs or maybe would-be entrepreneurs or people that want to be in the starting up something, or employees that want to get engaged with a brand that is focused on, you know, similarly to what you've built. They always kind of ask, like, you know, should I do it, or what should I do, or how can I get involved? And just, you know, what would you just say to somebody that might ask you that question?
Yeah, I would say that there's a million ways to run a business and run a profitable business too. I could count numerous times where I've been offered ways of, you know, building or growing or this and that in ways that would not align with my core values. So it's really a matter of what's your why? Like, why do you want to do it? Do you want to do it just to make a lot of money? There's a lot of ways to make a lot of money, and you can step in a lot of people and places and, you know, turn a blind eye on how things are made, you know. And I think that's kind of like the story of The Lorax too, in a way, right? You know, they're just marketing this random thing to everyone to buy. They don't even know why they want it, creating hype around it. And it's just creating waste. And it's like, you could, that stream always exists. You could always suddenly walk into that stream. It's a lot harder to go down this path, but I think the long-term value is there. So I always say to people, like, find your why. Like, why are you doing this at the end of the day? And if your why is because you have a story, you want to make great change and this and that, there will be people that are responsive to it. You have to trust the fact that you will attract like-minded people. But at the same time, if you go the other path, you're going to attract people that only care about, you know, trends and this and that or whatever. Like, you'll find your group, you'll find your tribe. We somehow did. I didn't even know they existed. I don't think social media was that advanced when we started either. So yeah.
I love the connection to the product that they made on the Lorax, and it's very, very true and funny that you're able to pull that out. Where can listeners find you online?
You can find us at shopnoctex.com. You can also find us on Instagram at Noctex. That's where we post a lot of behind the scenes. You know, I try to get people to see the day-to-day process, videos of me taking fabric to the factory and other sorts of stuff. So people can really see at the end of the day, you know, what goes into the product that they're buying online.
Well, thank you for joining us, and congratulations. From, I can just picture you climbing up mountains of clothing in your humble beginnings and selling on Etsy to where you and the team have taken the business. And so congratulations. We will be cheering you on, and please check out Noctex and, you know, support, because as you can hear, it's, you know, a lot of harder work and a lot of things to do, but it's paying off. And I think that's what's that's so amazing. So thank you again for joining us today.
Yeah. Thank you so much for your time and for letting me share, you know, a bit of our journey with you on this podcast today.
This podcast is co-produced with The Brand is Female. I hope you've enjoyed today's episode of Someone Like You. And if you did, please share this. We're a new podcast, and I would love it if you could share it with a family member, friend, colleague, work colleague, share it on Slack, whoever you do, just share and spread the message of these incredible brands. Please also support these type of companies. They're doing the hard thing, and the hard thing often takes a lot of people to get on board. And don't forget, please subscribe on the platform of your choice and give us a rating and review. I'm Marco Pimentel. Thank you for joining us today. For more information on Someone Like You, you can find us on Instagram at Someone Like You Podcast, with all the links to the podcast, our website, and more information about the brands that we feature. Thank you again.